Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Thanks for listening to this podcast produced by Diddy TV. Visit DiddyTV.com for more exclusive on-demand content or download the official Diddy TV app from your app store today. Welcome to Insights, everyone, where our guest this hour is husband and wife Americana rock duo, The Hawthorns, an immediately lovable group whose smart twang, pop hooks, and feel-good vibes are alive like never before on their brand new album, Tarot Cards and Shooting Stars, which is available this week via Mule Kick Records. The Hawthorns are KP and Johnny Hawthorne, both very well-respected artists and producers in their own right, KP having toured the country with Jamie Wyatt and others as a member of Calico and co-founder of Mule Kick Records, and Johnny as a jack-of-all-trades, most notably as a lead guitarist with bands like Toad the Wet Sprocket and Everclear. Today they chat with Amy Wright all about their careers and new life together in Nashville, and of course, their new album. So relax and listen in as we welcome to Insights, The Hawthorns.
So you guys are two of the most prolific artists I have ever met. You have so many projects going at any given time, and I just had to ask, does that keep you sane in this world? Just to have a lot of eggs in the basket, things going?
Does it keep you sane?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's planned out like that, but I just think that you'll be working on a project and then something else will come up and then you have to plan around that and then things just accumulate and next thing you know, your plate's full with all these different projects.
I have to do it. It's like it's my blood.
Well, and Tarot Cards and Shooting Stars is your latest, it's your new album, and we're going to talk about that. But before we actually get to the album, I want to talk to you each a little bit individually and give people a little bit of a background because you both had amazing solo careers and then you got together and you're married, that's no surprise to anyone, but you're doing great things together now. And so I just wanted to kind of go back and I thought I would start with you, KP.
Oh, sure.
And Johnny, you're next, ladies first in this one.
Stand by.
And so where did you grow up, KP?
I grew up in California. We're originally from the Central Coast. My whole family, we have generations of Californians all up and down from Northern California all the way down. Both my grandparents had lots of brothers and sisters, and they're both Californians. So it's like generations of Californians. But I did spend a lot of time in Southern California and went to school there and everything and started playing music in Southern California.
Did you learn music in school or who kind of inspired you to start learning music? And was it vocals first, guitar first? I mean, how'd that happen for you?
Well, we were just talking about that the other day because my mom just would always have she'd have a guitar out my mom played saxophone. She plays piano. She plays guitar. She basically plays anything that you put in front of her. And so there were just always instruments around. And so it kind of becomes part of your, just who you are when we were always encouraged to pick up things and try them. And the other thing she'd always do is have my sister and I would be, driving in the car with her and she'd sing. We had this one song that she'd always sing the melody to, and then she'd tell us how to sing the harmonies. And this is from the time we're four. So it just kind of was part of our lives forever. And then I eventually did all the choirs and choir in college and things like that and got my singing chops. But I just always loved singing. So guitar is secondary.
I know. I think we all kind of, if you're a musician, you kind of have something that is your comfort zone, mm-hmm. whether that's vocals, it's guitar or you know, violin or saxophone or whatever it is. I was talking to an artist just the other day who is a solo artist and sings solo, but said that her comfort zone is really singing the harmony because she grew up singing the harmony part. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we all kind of have that comfort zone. And were you in a band in high school? I mean, did you start performing or were you just really more in folk choruses and stuff?
Yeah, I didn't see myself as that kind of performer until a little bit later, like when I was probably in my mid 20s. I didn't really try. It kind of came to me. I just always wrote songs and played, and people who I knew said, oh, you need to take this to, you know, so-and-so and see if they'll, you know, want to work with you, whatever. You know how that happens. You sort of just do your thing and then network a little bit and it just kind of happens. And then I remember at one point started working with a person from Arthur Spivak's office who just heard one of my songs that I entered in some weird contest. And that was like the Tori Amos company. And that's how it all happened. It all happened for me very strangely. The first time I got placed on television with my songs, which I did for years and still do, I mean, just hundreds of and hundreds of TV placements, came from just playing a live show and a guy from Sony Music Television being there at the show and calling me the next day and saying, I'd like to put your song on a show. I mean, so that's kind of been, I stumble into things, I guess.
And that was Lucky Girl, right? And were you already in LA? And you were a lucky girl, I guess, because you were getting all these songs on the radio or actually in television. So you were already in LA. And when did you move to LA?
Well, I was living outside of Los Angeles at the time. I was living in the Inland Empire. So I'd have to come in to play shows and work with people and everything. But I didn't actually move to live in LA until around 2010, I get to 11 is when I actually moved to Burbank and started Calico and that kind of thing a couple years after. But I was always kind of hovering around Los Angeles between like 2005 and on.
What was the music scene like in LA? Because I hear it can be very competitive. And I was wondering, is it collaborative as well?
That's such a good question. I feel like there were pockets of both. And it's changed so much too. LA has changed tremendously because it used to be a lot more artist friendly of a city, but it's become so expensive and the traffic's so bad. It's hard. It's harder, I think, for artists to live there and be an artist there. But not to say that there aren't fantastic artists there, but I found a community of people who, you know, were collaborative and helpful and positive. But I did see that, you know, in certain areas, you know, I always kind of had this feeling too, like if you settle in with a clique, I'm not talking about a community, but I'm talking about a clique that, you know, keeps to themselves and, you know, keeps it tight and doesn't allow other people in, then you're going to get in there. Fine. You're in the clique, but you're never really going to be any more than that clique. And that's, I feel like how the cliques were, especially like in 2008, 2009, the little clicky sections of I don't know, the songwriter scene. But, you know, overall, the artistry was there and it still is there. But, you know, there were so many places to play. There was a Highland Ground scene. Remember that?
Yeah.
There were all kinds of these acoustic singer songwriter nights that were there. And I met a lot of beautiful, supportive people who became my longtime friends. So, yeah, I guess a little bit of both.
So what was it like to get your songs as on the soundtrack of a television show? Was that instant sort of recognition for you? And what did that do to you as an artist? Did you feel more confident in your songwriting capabilities when you were recognized that way?
That's so funny. Yeah, because I guess it does sort of validate all the hard work you've been doing and validate that, wow, this is something that's worthwhile. and I can actually have a make a living at this. And it did make me feel, gave me a little sense of power, like I can continue this and I can, you know, look what I could do. So I was going to say, in regard to the what it feels like, I remember just being kind of blown away, you know, when I first heard it on the actual television, you know, just like, wow, that's me. And I did that. So yeah, it was a pretty good thing. And I think too, you know, somebody giving importance to your work does make you want to go out and do it more. It's like, you know, you kind of have step ladders of validation. And that was a good one for me.
No, it's very true. I have a friend who's a chef. And I said, how did you become a chef? And he said, well, I was 12 years old and I was a latchkey kid. And I was a big kid. I was a football player. And so I actually started making burgers when I came home from school at 12 because I needed something to eat. And then all my friends started coming over because I was making burgers. And they said, you're the best cook ever. And he said, and all of a sudden I was like, I can do this. I can be a chef. You know, there's something that's really important about that validation that comes from other people, even though we would like to think it doesn't, but it does. It is helpful.
It is. Like, I have a friend, his name is Bruce Whitkin, and he's like the first real producer that I worked with. Just a really neat guy in LA. And, the first time I ever went into that studio, because I always kind of felt like it was a hobby. This is when I first started. I felt very hobbyish about what I was doing because that's all it really was at the time. But when I got in there to that studio and he took my song so seriously and took things apart and started really showing me what could be done and bringing other people in and watching the other people in the room take things seriously about the music, that also gave me another perspective of, wow, this something I'm made is being like, that's all we're working on all day. So it has a level of importance that it didn't have before. So it's pretty cool.
So when did you start Calico with Jamie Wyatt and Manda? Is it Mosher or Mosher? I wasn't sure.
Mosher.
Okay.
Well, we started that. Do you remember that movie? The Lone Ranger movie that had Johnny Depp in it.
Oh yeah.
My friend Bruce actually was working on getting music in for the movie. And he said, why don't you write some songs and see if we can submit for this film? And I said, okay, well, you know, I'd like to have like female harmonies, you know. And I had been kind of following Manda online. I'd seen her play live a few times. Jamie and I had already worked together on some things, and she was kind of like a little sister to me. And I invited them to a songwriting session. And that was in early 2013, I think, 2013 or late 2012, right around there. And we wrote one song together, and that was the Lone Ranger song. We called it Lone Ranger. And we had so much fun, and it gave us all, like, it just was so instant. And I remember in that session, we're like, we should start a band. And we did. So, and that went on for quite a while.
So what do you think was really special about, it was all girls, right? So what was special about Calico?
For me, it was the first time I'd ever worked with just women on any real project on the art side and the business side. And seeing their acumen in regard to both aspects was really powerful to see, wow, you know, we three we're just, you know, we're singing together, we're writing these songs together, we're plotting out a career, and, you know, we're starting from zero. It's like alchemy, you know, we just come together and create this thing. And just the daily discovery of what could be done and how much, not that like a band like this, you know, a four-piece band, a rock band, whatever, isn't a really amazing thing, but there's something about three female harmony group that when you're in the zone and you're all kind of on the same page, how much power there is in it. And there was a lot of draw to the band because they're both just, you know, very talented women. It was a ride. it was definitely, it had some amazing peaks for us as just even personally. It was just a really, really beautiful thing to do.
Well, and spoiler alert, because we're going to get to the fact that you guys met and at some point you wanted to work together as opposed to solo. But before I get to that, I've got to talk to you, Johnny.
Because
you're still here. You're still here. And I love the lid, I have to say. It's one of my favorites. You've got the classic.
Yes.
That is the classic lid. So your guitar playing has been compared to all sorts of really famous people, and not to make you uncomfortable, but even Jimi Hendrix and other people. And so I know you're an incredible guitar player and songwriter and all those things. And where did you grow up? Were you in LA as well, or were you someplace else?
I grew up outside of Philadelphia.
Oh, wow. You really were in someplace else. You weren't even on the West Coast.
And I was the youngest out of six kids, and none of my older brothers and sisters played an instrument. But at a young age, I got interested in guitar. There was a lot of music in the house and got interested in guitar. And it just seemed at that point, a lot of things were going on in Los Angeles with the music industry, and always have been, you know. And so you'd read these books and read the back of album covers, you know, when we used to have them, and you'd see all these references to like the Sunset Strip and Gazzari's and the Whiskey A Go-Go and stuff. So I left Philly when I was 16 and basically made my way out to Los Angeles when I was 18. And I'd been there ever since. Spent several years just meeting people and absorbing the music scene, I guess you could call it. It's very intimidating when you come out there. There's a lot of stuff going on and a lot of distractions. But eventually I honed in on what I needed to do as a player, which was practice, get my craft down. And then my philosophy was to join as many bands as possible, original bands, so I could get experience playing in front of stage, like on, you know, in on the club circuit and everything. And that's what I did. And so for many years did that. And then people would see you playing live and then you would get more work from that. And that's basically, you know, you spend your years doing that, and then eventually move up to being hired as a side touring musician, and did that for many years, and then eventually wanted to do my own thing, which was to write songs, not like just be an instrumental type of guitarist, but like a songwriter type. And I started doing that, and then also got involved with writing music for TV and soundtracks and things of that nature. And then eventually we did meet. Yes. So I don't want to give that away just yet, but.
Oh no. Oh no. We have to have the tension, you know, we can't give that away just yet. But so was there a guitar player that you emulated? Was there someone style that you really thought, if I could be that guy, that guitar player, that's who I would be?
Well, I love all the guitar players. I mean, you know, the constant question is like, who's your favorite and who influenced you the most? And there's just every guitar player has a little piece of something that I really like. However, there's like, if I could be a guitar player in somebody's band, I think like Peter Gabriel or like Sting, something like that, where you have a lot of different styles going on. Cause I feel like, as a player, I like to explore different things. And so to, you know, to say, you know, like, well, I'm only interested in playing Jimi Hendrix, which is fine. I mean, Jimi Hendrix did a lot of different styles, of course, too. But
who are your favorite ones that you?
There's too many to list.
I mean, if I were going to answer that question for you, I'd say Eddie Van Halen and Jeff Beck.
Yeah. Yeah. But then, you know, you have Jimmy Page and you have songwriters too that influence you too. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, different parts of your life, you'll get into different styles of music too. And like what I listened to, you know, 10, 15 years ago is different from what I listen to now. Mm-hmm. And you mature, or for lack of a better word, you just, your tastes change. So there's certain things you go back and you don't, I mean, like you go back and you listen to it and you're like, oh yeah, I used to listen to that stuff, but now I'm listening to this stuff over here. So it all comes together though and helps, put together your style.
Yeah.
Well, and you played with some pretty big bands. You played with Toad the Wet Sprocket. You played with Everclear.
Yeah.
And what was that experience like for you as a young person playing with bands that are touring in pretty big venues? And was that exciting? Was it a little bit scary when you first joined these bands?
It was very exciting, and they were all great, and it was definitely a learning experience. And what I realized with both of those acts is that they had already done the hard work of the years of touring. For both of those acts, I got involved with them after, I wasn't in the original incarnation of the band. I was like 10 years after the fact. But I really appreciated the fact that they crafted really good songs that held up, and they developed an audience that would obviously show up to all their gigs and stuff around the country. And also the discipline to, when you write a song, that you play the song, you respect the audience and you play the song as it was written so that they can enjoy seeing you play it live. Whereas sometimes when you're playing in whatever, bar bands and cover bands and things, at least my experience is a lot of improvisation going on. And so I came from that kind of background. And then when I got involved with these bands, it's like, no, you got to play it the way it was on the record. So that was something that I had really never experienced before. So that taught me a lot about that. Yeah, good experience all the way around.
So you put out 3 solo albums during this time period, and you write music. Were you writing just for yourself, or did you actually write music for, other people?
Well, what happened was you'd write music, and it was kind of the infancy, or not the infancy, but the beginning of what was called libraries. Now, there was always libraries where film and television would procure music, but it had been kind of like a small kind of thing, as far as I understand it. So when I started, when I did the first record, I got a lot of people, because I always do a couple instrumentals on there, and I would have people say, hey, this would sound really good on TV. And so I was like, yeah, well, how do you get it on TV? I don't know. I don't know. So
how do you?
Yeah, well, I did it the old fashioned way. I waited till the credits rolled, and then I wrote down whoever did the music, and then I sent them an email. and then they responded, and they're like, yeah, send us your music. And mm-hmm. So it was as simple as that. But then from there, they're like, okay, well, that's just, 2 songs, that you can send to them. But they, for a library, you need tons of songs. So I got involved in the production and the writing of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And that started many, many years ago, probably like 15 now. And you just keep adding to it and working with those guys. And it's a great way to make a living too.
Okay, so who wants to tell me how you met?
Oh,
what's that story?
Do you want the true story or the fake story? Because I have the true
story.
Well,
no, just tell them about.
Okay. So Johnny and I, we're both musicians in LA, obviously. And we had crossed paths several times through the years, starting from probably in like 2008, just playing, here and there. He played with a girl named Nicole Gordon, who would play on some shows that I played on in my solo life. And so we probably saw each other there. The rumor is that actually he asked somebody about me at a gig.
Johnny, you were already checking her out, just to be clear, right?
Oh, yeah.
He admits it. So I'd gone to live in Oregon just for like a year, and I came back. And the first thing I did was go to this place called the Cinema Bar, which is in Culver City, which that's where pretty much he lived, in Venice. And I had just gone in there. I went to go just visit a friend, and there was nobody else in the bar. And this guy comes walking in and just comes and pulls up a chair next to me. And we ended up having this great conversation for like an hour or two or something, and got to know a lot about him. And I was like, that was such a nice person, just a cool, nice guy. That was like 2012. And then time went by, and we kept crossing paths and stuff. And he thought I had a boyfriend, but I didn't. And anyway, eventually we played at the Hotel Cafe together. We were playing with
Amanda. We were on the same bill. Yeah.
And he was shy. And I tried to flirt with him, and he was like, I'm shy. So then one day we'd just gotten off the road with Calico. We'd been on the road for a month, and some friends were going to be playing at the cinema bar. And I said, okay, I'm going to go down there tonight. And I did. And who comes stumbling in, but this guy.
No, I didn't stumble in.
He walked in very straight, and we locked eyes, and that was it. That was the beginning of it. And that was 2014. And we've been together ever since. In pure bliss, right, honey?
Well, yeah. And then just as a footnote to that, she was still with Calico and I was still doing my thing. So we started the relationship, and we didn't really...
Don't tell this story yet.
We didn't want to cross-pollinate, meaning like, you know, we talked about doing a music project together, but we weren't like, you know, mm-hmm. Well, let's wait till the time is right.
Yeah.
Right. So you weren't the Hawthorns, which you are now.
No.
At that point, you were doing your solo thing.
Yeah.
And I was wondering that if you kind of continued after you met each on your own career path. Obviously, it's very helpful when you live together and you play music, and there's a lot of cross-pollination that goes on just organically, I would think, when you when you're together. But when how long was it before you actually thought, hey, we should do an album together?
Well, we thought of that right off the bat, but mm-hmm. but KP had put a lot of work into Calico, and it was, you know, it was going really good at mm-hmm. the time. So I said, you know, let's not even write stuff, because it undermines sometimes the band you're working in if they find out you're doing stuff on the side, so to speak, even if you're just writing songs, you know, harmlessly. So we just decided to wait until till the coast was clear, and eventually, you know, Calico ran its course, and once that was clear, then we're like, okay, now we can write.
Yeah, I mean, we kind of saw it coming. It, you know, got tough with families, and one of the members had a baby, and it got complicated to go on tour. So I could see that it was like, okay, this isn't going to last much longer. And I was like, we got to write some stuff. Let's do it. And the second it was over, I said to him, can we just please now just go for it? Because, and it's fun. It's easier because we're in the same house, and you know, we can talk about this kind of stuff we don't have to have a meeting. We don't have to schedule anything. We're just like, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? There's a lot of things that we can just hit, topics we can touch. And like, I'll hear him, he plays guitar all the time, and I hear him, you know, jamming something, and I'll go, I love that. Can we have that? You know, can we use that one? Can we write something? And so, you know, it keeps it all in house.
Yeah.
So how does that work? Is it easier because you're married, or harder sometimes, or, you know, how do you actually collaborate and do so in a way that doesn't get in the way of your relationship?
Well, it works just like, I suppose, anything else would work. But to what she was saying before, we're always around each other. So the difference, I would say, is normally when you're in a band situation, you have to rehearse. So everybody has to meet up, rehearse, or you have to get together for songwriting sessions, where we can do that on the fly. It's like, hey, let's jam on this tune right before we make dinner or something. Mm-hmm. So I think it's, from a convenience standpoint, it's pretty good because we're together all the time. And depending if or, you know, if we're into the mood or whatever you want to call it of writing, we can do it right away. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think it kind of works both ways in a way, because that's really true. But then also sometimes, because we are together all the time, we push it aside sometimes, don't you think?
Oh, well, that's just true too. Yeah. Because you know, it's always there. So you get kind of.
But it's become so ubiquitous. Like the entire music and love and life is all, that sounds so cheesy, but it's so true. It's like everything is all of it. It's all happening all the time. And there's no real separation anymore, especially since we are putting out a new record, and the setup to this record has been so intense. And so it's been really, you know, we've had to work at it, putting all the pieces of the puzzle together. And so it's like every day there's things to do, and we just accept that that's what's going on, and we schedule our life in between. And yeah. I don't know. It's a kind of all one big thing now.
But it seems to work.
So in 2019, you put out your first album. Was that Morning Sun? Is that what it was called? Mm-hmm. And so were you excited to get out on the road and tour? And we know what happened right after that, right? So what was it like to put out an album in 2019? Were you able to tour? Or did you kind of have to put a hold on that because of the pandemic?
Well, the album came out in July.
August, yeah. We got on the road in July, yeah. And it came out in August, and we stayed on the road all year.
Yeah, well, all half a year.
Yeah, half a year. And then we came back to Nashville. We hadn't really been living here yet, but we had this place here. And then he went home to LA, and we thought, okay, we're going to take a minute. And he's going to do some things he has to do in LA. I'm going to do some things here. And I think it was February, we just came off the road. We did the East Coast in winter. And then suddenly everything was getting shut down. So it was a real bummer, because I felt like we were just getting our engines turned on. We had some really cool things planned for 2020. And, you know, we were going to meet back in Austin, Texas. We had a showcase at South by Southwest that never happened. So, you know, you kind of just go, now what do you do? We're a brand new band. Nobody really knew who we were. So all that momentum that we had been creating just got stopped. And, you know, so we're just grateful to be here and now with another chance to, you know, get the word out and do this, because we love doing this. We love performing together.
Well, I was treated to an advanced copy of your album, and, It is a great album. I'm not just saying that, but it's really fun. The melodies are great. The harmonies are great. Guitar licks. I was just having so much fun listening to it. And it's obviously Tarot Cards and Shooting Stars. But before we just talk just about that, I also wanted to mention you have a documentary coming out, Palamania. And I just wanted you to tell people what that is, because I think it's such a cool concept, and I personally can't wait to, you know, see it. So tell us what it's about.
Me too. I can't wait to see it. it's in the editorial stage of its existence, and it's called Palamania. It's the story of Palomino Club of North Hollywood that existed from 1949 to 1995. My partner, Adrian Isom from the band No Kona, and I put the whole idea together. You could go to mulekickproductions.com if you want to find out more about that. But it's the history of the venue, but it's also the untold story of California country music and the influence of the West Coast on country and roots and Americana and everything that we love. And, you know, people are going to be able to look back and go, wow, those are my roots. I didn't even know that. So it's going to be a really exciting thing.
Yeah, I think it's a very cool story to tell. And what's interesting is that connection, like you're describing. And you guys then moved from LA to Nashville, which kind of almost demonstrates that connection in Americana and country between those two areas. Most people don't realize that California had this thriving country Americana scene and a little bit different flavor of that music than you had, say, even in Texas or the midsection of the country and then the eastern part of the U.S.
Yeah, they were the real rebels. You know, there was Leo Fender. There was Capitol Records making just different kind of country music. There were all the honky tonks, you know, the nudie suits started on Lancashire Boulevard, right across down the way from the Palomino Club. So all of that stuff, the style, the look, and the sound of country music, a lot of the things that we think of as being from here in Nashville really originated in California and got to you know, try themselves out there and really, you know, grow and develop in California.
Well, I'm really looking forward to that. And during the pandemic, you were obviously writing tarot cards and shooting stars. And when did you record it? And, you know, when was it all kind of ready? And where did you record it?
Well, we started putting, well, actually, no, what happened was so even though we moved out here for the pandemic, we still kept the place in LA. So but you know, everything was kind of shut down, but we'd have to go back there every other month or every 2 months. So we went back there, and the place where we recorded the first record, or some of the songs on the first record, we were hanging out there and we're like, well, let's go ahead and record something while we have, you know, there's nothing going on. So we got out our phones.
When was it?
Like May.
Yeah, that was May of this year.
Of last year.
We started May of last year. Yeah, that's true.
And so we called up our drummer from the first record and the bass player, and we laid what's called basic tracks. And then at the same time, when we first moved out here, our house is kind of small and we don't really have any place to record music. So I built a little bit of a studio in the backyard, and we were just finishing that. So I said, let's just do the guitar stuff back here in Nashville. So we took those tracks, did the guitar stuff here, and sent the tracks back to LA and put them in with the mix. And then I we came back to LA.
Back to LA in like August and finished vocals and layered stuff.
Yeah, kind of did the finishing touches.
Yeah.
And then, and that was pretty much it, you know?
And it's funny because we didn't even, when we were there in May, when we were first recording with our friend Steve, who has been our production partner on a lot of things, he was like, why don't we make a record, or what do you have? What can we record? And I said, well, I got a few songs. And I picked up my phone and I started going through and like listening to all my voice memos and stuff. And I went, Oh, that one's pretty good. And by the time I got done, I said, wow, we've written a whole bunch of stuff. I have a whole phone full to prove it. So we weren't even planning on it. We just, right then and there, we called our drummer and said, come. And he came down from, he was staying in the Bay Area. He came the next day, stayed for 2 days and recorded all the drums. And it was COVID, so, you know, we're trying to be careful. Then the next day, the bass player came, and, you know, it was one of those really easy, fun, no stress kind of situations, a great recording vibe.
Yeah, sometimes when you don't plan stuff, it goes smooth.
Yeah.
So the name Tarot Cards and Shooting Stars sort of evokes for me your dreams and the future, but what was it that, you know, about that particular phrase that that you came up with for this album?
Well, we had a song called On the Way on the record, which is, I think it's song two. And that song is about all of the things that you plan to do. And you can't control so many aspects of what life hands you. And sometimes you find out that when you're on your way to where you think you're going, and you end up somewhere else, you're really in the right place. And one of the lines in that song is, tarot cards and shooting stars can't say whether you should try to break away or stay the course and drive another day. So we just thought that was kind of the overall message of this entire record. It is a record about taking what you have and making the best of it, and being grateful for what you have, and just how changing our perspective. Cause, you know, we all went through a lot for the last year and a half, 2 years now. So
Would you say it's a hopeful album, as in it's positive, dealing with some pretty tough subjects, obviously, we've all been dealing with, but would you say by and large, it's more on the hopeful side?
I think absolutely it's on the hopeful side. I kind of can't help writing that way when I'm feeling that. I know a lot of people gravitate toward writing when you feel really down. It's like that's a good songwriting place for a lot of people, which I can relate to completely. But it's so nice to be able to see the beauty in something dark and to see your way out of it and to appreciate what you went through. And that's me as a human being, I think, just like being able to walk through the darkest valleys and forests and, you know, scary places and come out the other side and look back and go, I went through that and I'm okay. So, yeah.
I think music has such a big role in pulling society out of these types of crises because we all know the soundtrack to our life, and so this is another part of that life. But I feel like all the musicians and artists I talk to that have written albums over the last 2 years that you're almost the documentarians and poets of this period that we've been going through. And so I felt a little bit of that when I was listening to your album.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, we Johnny and I discovered the Steve Poltz quarantine blues over the quarantine. Did you hear that one?
Oh my God. Yeah. You know, I love Steve. Okay, I'm just gonna put it out there. He's so great. He makes me laugh all the time.
Yeah.
He's great.
But I mean, to your point of, you know, artists, you know, documenting the history of what we just went through in such a funny, deep, passionate, and succinct way. I agree with you. Like, you could just take all the music that was released over the last year and a half and you could get an idea. You could, you know, time capsule that.
Yeah.
For future generations, and they would know exactly what we all went through.
Future pandemics.
Hopefully not again. Just throwing it out there that I could just not do this again. But so, you know, you have all these amazing original songs, and you chose one cover, and it was Lot of Love, that was originally a Nicolette Larson song, right? And why that particular song?
Well, it was originally Neil Young, and then...
Oh, Neil Young, okay.
We had read the Ted Templeman book. We read a lot of
books.
He's
a producer.
Yeah, he's a producer, an old school producer. He's like 80 something years old now.
Right.
And he recorded a lot of that, you know, California roots rock and roll stuff that happened in the 70s. And he had the story about Neil and Nicolette, and he was telling a lot of great backstories about that. And, you know, while we're reading it, we're like, wow, that is a really great song. You know, it's just like, it's kind of a song that doesn't really go anywhere. I don't like, what's the chorus? I don't even know. Right. So we were just talking about it. We both love Neil Young. And I come from that whole, like, my mom was a Laurel Canyon, you know, music enthusiast. And that's what I grew up on listening to. So all that stuff was just real meaningful to me. Anytime I get an excuse to record one of those artists' songs, then I'll take it. But Johnny and I'm doing all the talking, aren't I?
That's all right.
How about you chime in, honey?
No, it was weird. It's one of those things where we read the book and the backstory of how the song was recorded. And then, like, everywhere we went, we started hearing the song through, you know, whatever, the Muzak systems and stuff.
In the grocery store and stuff.
So I think it was like, it was a higher power calling.
It was.
Record this song, you know?
Yeah. And we were in the studio that day that we told you about when we were going through the phone, and we found 9 really good ones. And then we're like, oh, we could really round this off with 10. We should just do 10. So I said, well, why don't we just like hurry up and learn this real quick? And we did.
Yeah.
So that's
well, you do a great version of it. And did Neil Young actually record it as well? And then she recorded it after him, or how did that work?
No, I don't
Who
know.
Did it first,
I
think it was Neil first though, but hers was the hit.
Yeah, hers was definitely a hit because everybody knows her.
And we had this whole conversation about the production of it because hers has horns and stuff, which I'm not a super huge fan of those
saxophone.
Yeah, the saxophone on that recording, but. the Neil Young version is so raw and just so Neil Young, you know. And I felt like we did something in between, like a real production version, but without horns, you know. I wanted to honor the Nicolette Larson thing that she did, but you know, it's also fun because we got to put all those harmonies and everything on it, and Johnny just came up with lines that didn't exist on the original recording, just kind of his own little guitar melodies and licks and stuff that I thought just, I love what he did on that song.
Yeah, well, the whole album is really great, and I have one last sort of question for you before we kind of have to go, but Mule Kick Records, so you have your own label, and what is involved, your involvement with other artists, and what does that do for you, and how do you pick your artists for the label?
The label started off because it was an element of the film, it was a production company for the film, and because the film has a soundtrack, we needed a home and a back end for the soundtrack. If that makes any sense. And then Nocona being the first record that we put out. Nocona is my partner Adrian's band. And it was during the pandemic. And I just said, let's put this great record out. And we put the whole machine of, you know, the little machine that we have. It's me and it's other people that we have that we hire on and that we trust a lot to do this push for this record. And after we put her record out, we're like, well, why aren't we doing this? We love doing it. And it's kind of a co-op in a way, because there isn't like a big financial thing that we have a big, you know, pot to dig through to get a bunch of money. But we do have a lot of sweat equity and we have a lot of talented people. So we just kind of brought on bands that made sense for us to bring on, that we had some other relationship with in a way, like Alice Wallace's new band, Side Pony with Caitlin Cannon, was a perfect match. And we had a lot of fun. Adrian did all the artwork. She's the art genius behind our everything. And Andrew Leahy, who we absolutely love, we put out his volume one, American Static volume one, and we're getting ready to do volume two. He's just a Nashville gem. And we've loved him ever since we met him. And that just seemed like a no-brainer. Rosie Flores, we put a couple of singles out. We're going to do some more music with her. And Rosie is in our film. So there's that. But we also made a record for a band called Desert Hollow, which is Xander Hitzig and Nicole Olney. And Xander is in also the band Nocona and plays with a lot of us. So that made sense. And the essence of it all is this musical like gamut between this side of Americana and this side. It's the full spectrum of what you would call Americana, being like psychobilly kind of, you know, cosmic rock and roll all the way through to folk music. We're going to put out a record for Susie Brown this year too, who's a real just, I don't know, her voice reminds me of like a Carole King meets like the Wild Colonials or something, songwriter here in Nashville. And yeah, I don't know if that made sense, but.
You know, it does, and it sort of comes full circle. And back to Johnny's comment about guitar styles, how really you just want to play a lot of different styles. You're a guitar player. You don't want to be lumped into one thing. And so working with all these different artists and being able to work with different subgenres of Americana roots kind of music and realizing how broad this is, I'm sure it brings a lot of joy and creativity to both of you. And of course, you're talented, and I'm sure it's helping these artists quite a bit too. And it sounds like there's a collaboration and collective there that works for everybody. But Tarot Cards and Shooting Stars, I love it, and I hope everyone goes out and gets a copy of it. When does it come out?
It'll be out available everywhere on February 25th.
February 25th. Okay, awesome. So we'll be sure to make sure on that day we do a little social post and get everyone out getting the album. And we really appreciate you stopping by Diddy TV and wearing the lid. I mean, you're representing over there, Johnny. I love it. And we can't wait to see you next time you're in Memphis, which I think is relatively soon.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we're looking forward to going back there. We love it there.
Awesome. Well, thank you guys. I appreciate it. Have a great rest of your week.
All right.
You too.
That's a wrap for this edition of Insights. Thanks so much for tuning in and for supporting the hardworking artists that we work with here at Diddy TV, like the Hawthorns. Their brand new album, Tarot Cards and Shooting Stars, is available this week via their own Mule Kick Records. So head over to their website or socials to secure your copy today. We asked about the name of the album, and they said it appealed to them for a title, particularly because there's been so much in the last couple of years that can't be controlled, and we could all use a little peek into the unknown. One thing we do know, they've put together one hell of an album. From all of us at Diddy TV, thanks again for tuning in today, and we hope to see you again soon, right here on Insights.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.